Good evening, everybody. I'm Nick Farr, and I'm here to talk about this little idea I have called cloud banking. Just to get things started, the overview of this talk, there's going to be a good deal of introduction, one about how banking is supposed to work, just sort of a refresher from perhaps your economics classes, and then how banking really works, because I don't believe that traditional banking as it's practiced today works for the people who are invested in the system, the people like you and me who have savings accounts, Euro cards, things like that. Then I'm going to try to introduce and bring in the idea of cloud banking, which is essentially massively distributed finance. Along with that, I want to try to introduce some parallel financial models, things that are actually existing, because what I'm trying to introduce today is very highly theoretical. While all of the tools to enable it and make it possible exist today, putting them all together and making them work is going to take a while. And the reason that I'm just throwing this out here is that my hope is that you'll take these ideas, start to play with them, bring them together, investigate the law where you live, and hopefully start your own bank and encourage your friends to start their own banks, and create this vast network of smaller institutions that are inherently more democratic and that are controlled by the people who have their savings and their income and their loans and other things invested in these smaller institutions. And then finally, I hope to have a little bit of time for Q&A at the end. But before I begin, just some shameless plugs. My Twitter is Nick Farr, N-I-C-K-F-4-R-R. The hashtag for the concept, if you're going to tweet about it, is pound cloud banking. My website is nickfarr.org, N-I-C-K-F-A-R-R.org. I will post these slides to my website within 3 or 4 hours after this presentation. So you can go ahead and feel free to download them there. And if you want to talk about the concept more, it's a WordPress blog. You can throw out comments. Feel free to email me, ask questions. I really want to encourage a dialogue and active interaction with the concept as I'm throwing it out here. Also, I just want to give a shout out to my good friend Jonathan Mann, The Rock Cookie Bottom, who's writing a song every day. And actually, for his Song a Day project, he's doing one song for each of the three keynotes. He did one for Jens's keynote this morning. He'll do one tomorrow for FX's keynote and one for my day three keynote if you happen to, for some awful reason, be up that early on Sunday morning. And of course, I want to give proper greetings to my number one heckling fan, Johannes Krenzferner of Monochrome down there. Cool. So now that the shameless plugs are over, economic theory is hard, even if English is your native language. So it's a small enough crowd so that if any particular phrase that I use, I know, number one Twitter winner, thank you very much. Yes, actually, I realized that I wouldn't have time to go over to the Hack Center to get some Mata, so I threw a shout out on Twitter for one, and one magically appears. I love these conferences. Yeah. So just to get back to the slide, if there's any phrase or piece of jargon or a sentence that's unclear, just wave your hand, be obnoxious, go ahead and yell out your question, and I'll try to clarify it for you as much as I can. And if I can't do it right then and there, we'll meet online. You can email me. We'll talk about it on the website. Also, just some other caveats. This talk is given from a primarily U.S. perspective, that most of the banking model and theory that I'm talking about is based in the United States. I know the German banking model is a little bit more egalitarian. It's also a little bit more hierarchical between the four kinds of banks that are in Germany that are slowly converging. And while differences do exist, they're slowly becoming one product, similar to the difference between credit unions and regular commercial banks in the United States. So just to warn you that things that I'm throwing out here are based more from a U.S. perspective, although the trends that we're seeing in U.S. banking are being reflected globally, and that they are coming, and that we're seeing them in the German model right now. Also, like I said, the concept is very highly theoretical. There are practical parallels behind it, but I can't, point to any place in the world and say cloud banking is being done there today. Hopefully, I'll be able to come back here next year and start pointing out the beginning signs of cloud banking. But like I said, it still does not exist in a corporeal form. And that's cool, because it gives you guys the idea to play with it and make the model your own. As I found out just talking about it and showing my slides to people here, I understand that Germans tend to be uncomfortable with the idea of money, with the idea of loaning money to friends or pooling money together with their friends and people that are in their social networks. And a lot of that sort of thing is what cloud banking is. So it may fail completely just for that pure cultural reason. I know Americans share some of those qualms, but are a little bit more flexible with how they use money among their friends and family. And again, I'm just throwing my ideas out there to as many people as possible so you can play with them and experiment with them. I'm not trying to pitch anything. I'm not trying to sell you on anything. I'm not even trying to say that we should overthrow the banking system as it exists. These are just my opinions and ideas for you to take or leave as you'd like. And so before I get into the real heart of it, I just want to clarify what money is. If you ask, you know, three people what money is, you'll get 12 different answers. So when I'm thinking of money, I think of it as primarily two things. The average economics professor will explain it three ways. I'm breaking it down into two ways. The first thing money is, it's an efficient metric for value. That when you're comparing what the market cost or the market price of two different things is, it's easiest to express it in terms of money. Just to take a quick example. This packet of Haribo, you know, might be worth €1. And my suit, you know, might be worth €600. It's easier to say that my suit is worth €600 and this is worth €1 than to say this is worth 1/600th of a suit, or to say that my suit is 600 packets of Haribo. Money's most efficient use is as a metric like that, by just saying that something is of this relative value across many different people in the marketplace. What money is not so good at as money is as a method of transferring and storing value. Unfortunately, it's all we have. We can't directly trade suits for Haribo. We can't trade Haribo for t-shirts or other things like that. All we have are money. It's an intermediary of value. And the core thing to remember about money is that when that value stored in money is in that intermediate state, it's losing value in a whole bunch of different ways. And that there's opportunities for rent and fungibility in when value is in that state. And another really core important thing to realize is that money in and of itself in Western economies is essentially worthless. Money has no intrinsic value. Haribo gummy bears have an intrinsic value. Suits have an intrinsic value. Computers have an intrinsic value. Money does not. All money does is allow us to trade for things like Haribo, computers, and suits. That's it. Have I lost anybody so far? Okay, cool. So, of course, just the textbook overview of how banking works. You earn money, you have a job, you sell things, you take that money, you put it in a bank account so that you can spend it, have a Euro card, have some place to put it so that it's not underneath your mattress, so that it's relatively safe. And then, you know, banks will take that money and they'll put it to good use and they'll loan it to customers so that they can start businesses and they can buy cars and houses and do all these wonderful different things. And, you know, the bank pays you interest so that your money's not losing value underneath the mattress. And, you know, the bank makes up for paying its employees and paying the rent for their bank branches and everything like that, with the difference in what they pay you in interest for the use of their money and what they charge their customers for in the use of their money. This is the classic textbook example that for some reason is still taught to school children everywhere that Western modern banking exists. What really happens with money? And granted, this is more my personal opinion. I'm not an economist by training. My background is in social science, and I work as an accountant. So I see a lot of what I believe is a destruction of value in the trading and manipulation of money as it occurs throughout the financial system. I'm just focusing on the banking sector because it's the easiest target. So taking the first assumption, you earn money. When you earn money, you know, through your work, through creating objects which you sell, through going to work every day, getting a paycheck, what you're doing for that money is actually creating some kind of value. The service that you're performing, the thing that you're making, you're doing actual work. that somebody, your employer, your customers, your clients, think is of some value that they pay you for. And then with that money that you earn, you know, you buy other goods and services that are of value. You pay your rent, you buy train tickets, you buy food, you buy clothing, all of these things of value, you know, that you believe are of value, otherwise you wouldn't be buying them. Unless that money is actually in cash form, unless you can hold it, that money never leaves the banking system. Things that you pay for with your Euro card, you know. Once that money hits your account, perhaps it's transferred directly into your account by your employer, and then you pay for things with your Euro card, and then that money gets transferred to the bank of the person that you bought it from, which then goes to pay employees and stays in the banking system. As long as that money never exits the banking system, and the only way it can exit the banking system is in the form of cash, and yes, there are a couple of other exceptions, but for the most part, as long as that money stays somewhere in the banking system, somewhere in the chain, there is somebody making money by virtue of the fact that that money is in their little part of the system. So, you know, while you earn money, while the money that you've earned is in the banking system, somebody else is making money just by virtue of the fact that it's there. And it's your money. And you're, with very few exceptions, not seeing any of that profit that's being generated while your money is in the banking system. You know, banks say they pay interest. The vast majority, at least in the United States as it stands, 89% of the accounts that are out there earn no interest. That's checking accounts that earn no interest, that's basic business checking, that's money that happens to be in transit. The money that's in the banking system is not actually earning money for the people who actually own it. And that's an important point. Money that's in the banking system, if it's yours, you own it. It's your property. You are giving it to the bank, you are loaning it, essentially, while it's in the form of your savings, but you still own it. The bank doesn't own it. But the bank treats that money as if they own it, and that they're making money off of your money at every step in the process. And on top of all of that, they charge you fees for the ability for you to transfer your money from place to place. On top of that, the people that you buy from, anybody who's a merchant account, you know, in the United States, we see a lot of convenience stores and places like that that have minimum fees for credit cards, because oftentimes 3, sometimes 4% of each of those transactions, you know, are going directly to the bank just for providing that ability to transfer that money in the form of credit cards or debit cards or things like that. And that over time, you know, as banks have introduced these systems to save money and preserve more money in the banking system so that they can continue to loan it out and leverage it and leverage it, with every new service that they introduce, they find a way to charge more fees and just generate straight profit from the fact that they are the gatekeepers of your money. And then on top of that, all of these systems that they've created, the intermediaries between banks, these clearinghouses, by having money for a few seconds or by waiting for money to clear, are also making money by virtue of the fact that they can loan that money that they have for a short period of time back into the banking system and then make profits from it themselves. You know, banks say that they loan money to customers, but in reality, banks take your money, they combine it up, they pile it up, and banks themselves, the people who are holding these funds, don't actually do a very good job of turning that money around and loaning it to smaller customers. Banks will take large chunks of your savings at any one time and give it to somebody else, you know, who might loan it to a major corporation, who might then loan it back to you at a much higher interest rate, having gone through various different steps of the process. And you know, if you're a banker, that makes the most sense. Commercial lending is the most lucrative. It's much easier to pile up $1 million or €1 million and loan it off at any one time than it is to take that €1 million and parcel it up into 10,000 euro bits and loan it to somebody with a good idea, or loan it to somebody who wants to buy a car, or loan it to somebody, you know, who has to pay for school or for a medical emergency or something like that. That servicing all of those transactions is much more costly to the bank, because they have to pay people to file the application, they have to pay people to look, make sure that you're creditworthy, they have to make sure that you're sending your payments in on time, whereas if they loan $1 million to a major corporation, at some point in the future they either pay it back or they don't. It doesn't take very many people to facilitate that transaction. So the cost of small business lending is not something that that the banking industry, as it's consolidating, is something that they can do very efficiently or do very well, or even have an interest in doing. And so the market costs for the small business person, for you and I, the people that are giving banks our money, is increasing just because of the consolidation of the banking industry. So the fact that they say, well, we take your money and we loan it back to you is by and large a myth. And yes, you know, the banks say if you have a savings account or you buy a CD with us or you have a time deposit that we pay you interest. The only people that really make interest off of banks are people who for some reason have a lot of cash lying around that aren't putting that money to any kind of good actual physical value creating use, or who just happen to be really, really rich. That this interest, quote unquote, that banks pay, you know, in the form of money market accounts or in the form of investment products, are actually that money, that interest that's being generated, is not being generated by anything that the bank's doing. The bank is merely acting as an intermediary between municipal lending, between other forms of money market investment, that the bank itself is not taking that money and creating any value and paying that back to you. They're handing it off to somebody else where they're collecting that interest that they pay back to you. Banks make most of their money, you know, purely off of fees and purely off of the fact that they have large pools of money that they loan to somebody else at any one given time, or by acting in that intermediary role to sell you other products and services that they make money off of. There are very, very few examples where somebody who's in the commercial banking system, and unfortunately, there are fewer examples of people who are in the credit or the Volksbanking systems that are coming out ahead by virtue of the fact that banks have their money. That, again, the whole thing that banks pay interest portion of the classic banking theory, I believe, is also a lie. And banks do nothing but profit from that spread, from the interest that they quote-unquote pay you, from the interest that they're collecting by virtue of holding onto your money. They make money by fees and rents, not actually creating any real economic value. And as banks grow bigger and bigger, and as smaller banks are bought up by bigger banks, as smaller credit unions combine and converge, and we are left with fewer banking institutions, all of these vast pools of money and the fact that they're fiduciaries for these vast pools of money creates a very vast temptation to engage in the massive kinds of speculation that we've seen and that have led to the current economic downturn. And we've seen this over and over again in history. Immediately preceding the Great Depression, we saw banks taking money and loaning it to people to engage in speculation in the stock market. The vast improvement of quality of life and the fact that India and China have ramped up their manufacturing processes and are creating large amounts of economic value and have large amounts of cash that they cannot apply or reinvest into their countries. The fact that these massive amounts of money and profit that are being generated from the sale of manufactured goods to the European Union, to the United States, to other industrialized economies are creating this opportunity for banks to take that money and say, hey, you know, we can earn you a very safe, high interest rate. And as more and more of this money becomes available, more opportunities for speculation happen. The more opportunities for speculation happen, the more leverage there is. The more leverage there is, the greater the fall and the deleveraging happens once they realize that they've essentially invested in another tulip market. And so while banks are continuing to be allowed to be big by virtue of the fact that we continue to give banks our money, and that governments continue to bail out big banks because they feel that they have no choice, this kind of massive speculation will continue to happen. It's a cyclical process that's happened ever since modern banking has existed, you know, going all the way back to the 17th century. And it will continue to happen until the banking system is taken back by the people who give banks their money. And so that's where the concept of massively distributed finance comes in. Before I get into this, do you have any questions about sort of my take on modern banking? Any theories, concepts, people who absolutely disagree with me? Have I put you guys to sleep yet? Okay, good. I've heard some laughing, so that means you're not totally asleep yet. And so the basic concept and idea here is that, like I said, as long as we continue to give our money to banks, banks will continue to consolidate, and they will continue to engage in speculation, and this is bad. The fact that there are institutions that are large enough so that they could not be considered to fail is in and of itself a market failure. That in a truly free market, in a truly even and distributed playing field, banks should never be allowed to get that big. that in the post-industrial era, we don't need large banks to fund large industrial products and to finance massive, massive projects. As we see advances in technology, everything's getting smaller. Everything's getting more distributed. We see cars not being built, you know, from very small parts and screws to complicated systems by one entity, but we see, you know, the current model of one entity designing a car and then farming out the manufacture of all of the various different parts to other entities. And as we're seeing, at least in the United States, the automotive industry coming to a complete failure, you know, we'll see all of these independent distributors come together and as separate entities leverage their core capabilities and come together to make a car, which might be marketed under, you know, an old traditional brand, which would turn companies like GM and Ford not into entities that design a car from the ground up, but might market the design of other companies. The other problem with convergence in banking, if it's allowed to continue to happen, is that it deprives individuals and smaller entities, and real entrepreneurs, the people who have always driven economic innovation, what I like to call economic entropy. Larger banks, like I said, as a general rule, don't like to loan to the small entrepreneur, don't like to give the entrepreneur just that little bit of capital that they need to continue to develop and enhance their ideas and allow them to test them out in the marketplace, that the individual inventor and entrepreneur feels generally powerless. You know, in this kind of a system, they feel that they have to develop this idea and essentially hand it over for a certain amount of money, if they're lucky, to a large corporation who can take and run with it. Whereas if we implement a slightly different banking system using the kinds of technologies that are in social networking that we're seeing throughout the internet right now that are leveraging trust networks and those sorts of things, that small entrepreneur that might only need, you know, 10, 20, 50,000 euros will be able to collect that in 2, 3, 5, 10 euro bits from many thousands of people so that they can realize that idea and bring it to a point where he can enter the marketplace and determine the validity of his ideas. The other part of that, the third core assumption that I'm making here, is that as individuals, these social networks, you know, the people who are more intimately familiar with the technology, even on a very surface level, are much better at deciding what the viability of these ideas is than a bank is. You know, a loan officer is not an engineer. A loan officer is not a computer programmer. A loan officer is not a business person. They're not an entrepreneur. Otherwise, they'd be an engineer, an entrepreneur, a coder, but they're a loan officer. You know, banking and computer models is what they know. So they're going to try to frame every kind of decision that they have to make into some kind of model or into some kind of rubric. And as the world gets more and more complex, and as the ideas that entrepreneurs are coming up with engage in much more complex and technical systems, the ability of loan officers, financiers, people in suits, to be able to gauge the relative worth of these ideas is going to get much more increasingly harder. That I think that as innovations spin out and fork and do all these different things, that we really need to return the decision of that viability, that gateway to capital, back to the people who are more intimately familiar with it. And I think with the advances in social networks that we're seeing across the internet today, the ability for gauging that risk is there and is available for people to do through, you know, what I'm calling massively distributed finance or cloud banking. At the same time, the fourth core assumption that I'm making here is that these social networks have a much better alert mechanism for determining and adapting to shocks in the economic system than banks do. Banks are always the last ones to find out that the people that they've extended credit to are effed. I'm trying not to swear here. That they're always the last to know that their clients are no longer creditworthy. But by leveraging the same social networks that are making that risk assessment and decision at the front end, you know, they're able to collect data and are able to adapt in time. That people who are in these social networks will be able to know when their friends are laid off, when there's trouble in that industry, when a certain technology has been ruled not viable, and be able to compensate and make arrangements and, you know, restructure sorts of things so that the entrepreneurs, so that the people who are on the loan end of that aren't left stranded with the decision of either just walking away from their project and defaulting or, you know, trying to scrape together or try to convince the bank that they are creditworthy and eventually crash and failure. They're able to intercede at a point in time where they can actually save and rescue the project, or at least gain some of that value back that would otherwise be lost in a foreclosure. Any questions so far? Yes, go ahead. I think that Facebook is a good classic example of a way of collecting that sort of information. I'm not saying that Facebook should turn into a cloud bank, but I'm saying that the kind of technologies that bring people together in a Facebook-like method are viable and are ways of creating these sort of decision-making rubrics. Just like Facebook applications, where people say, join my crew or my posse or do things like that, and people are able to create sort of a fake value by bringing these people together through leveraging their immediate social networks and their second and third degree social networks for event invitations, for friend invites, for all these other applications that are essentially play or facilitators of social interaction. What if somebody has a good idea or a business plan or says, I want to create this company, and then invites all of their friends in their immediate social circle to say, loan me 10 euros of your savings so that I can buy this equipment and do these sorts of things to start my business. And then those people that would loan them 10 euros say, well, I loan this guy 10 euros, and then it goes out to all of their friends. And slowly and surely, instead of borrowing from banks, getting sort of back to my slide here, and letting them profit, from the fact that they're holding on to our money and making loans based on their faulty decision-making mechanisms with it, and profiting from fees and all these other things. The core idea behind cloud banking is, let's use the technologies that we're developing to sort of enhance our social lives. Let's use the deregulation of banks that's been happening in the Eurozone and in the United States to let us make decisions of what happens with our own money and savings as it's in the system. Let's take back our money and say, we're going to loan to our friends, we're going to loan to our family, we're going to loan to their friends and their family. And when we need to borrow money, we're going to borrow back from those networks. And we're going to cut banks out as a middleman entirely. Ego, you had a question. Just go ahead and say the question, I'll repeat it.
As I understood the idea of crowd banking, so a normal person who somehow got the idea of the project is giving money to the project. So isn't this exactly the idea of the stock market? Well, as it was the idea back 100 years ago. So a person can go to the stock market, give the money to a company who does something with this.
Well, at least now we have a working microphone for other questions. Ego's core question wasn't this kind of lending idea the idea behind the stock market? And yes, that was the idea behind the stock market, that somebody has an idea, they cast a prospectus, they go after investors, and the investors, in exchange for a potential share of the profits generated from that idea, will give the person with the idea, the company, a certain amount of money. And that, in theory, that the profits of that company will be shared across all the different investors. Yes, that was the core idea behind the stock market. And as anybody who studied stock theory lately knows, that's absolutely not the use of the stock market today. That even theoretically, the stock market's core function is essentially as a store, an arbiter of value, and a determination of the viability of companies. Taking an investor's money, putting it into the coffers of a company for them to create economic value with, is something that, by and large, the stock market no longer does. Anybody who lived through the dot-com era knows that that's not, that of all of the money that was generated in that era, how much of it actually ended up in creating a value-generating activity? Or even ended up just in the hands of people who happened to be around working for those corporations. It didn't happen that way. That any any statistical model that you take for studying the efficiency of the stock market in applying money into the hands of those who are creating value knows that that's not what the stock market does today. But Igor is right, that's essentially the fundamental idea behind it. The stock market takes that and turns it into equity. Equity meaning it's not a direct loan, that what you're essentially saying there is that by owning that stock, you have the rights to all of the future cash flows of that company. That's the idea of owning one share of stock. What I'm saying is that instead of engaging in an equity market, let's just engage in a straight cash loan market. You know, and this applies with everything, not only just from startup ideas, but from loans that people get to buy cars, to buy houses, to fund temporary projects or expansion of their homes or medical emergencies in the United States, and different things like that. I'm saying the core function of banks is to loan money. You know, let's loan to each other. Let's borrow from each other. Let's not, you know, give banks 17, 18, 25, 29.9, in some cases, percent for short-term lending. You know, and letting them take that and essentially profit off of money. That my belief is that banks, by and large, of all of the profits that they make, they're creating very little value by virtue of the fact that they happen to control a lot of money. Quick question, yeah.
Do you introduce monetary interest in your cloud banking?
Yeah, no, the point that the interest that's generated does go essentially to pay for the systems and goes directly back to those who are loaning the money. The idea behind cloud banking is that when the system that you're engaging in say loans out something at 6%, you know, which might be a very favorable interest rate depending on the risk involved, whereas the bank would keep maybe 5.9% of that and give you back a tenth of a percent of that. Instead, under a cloud banking model, depending on the cost of the system, depending on risk and default and things like that, the system might absorb, just through sheer economic activity, 1% of that, giving you 4% back. That spread that banks keep, because cloud banking is not designed to make profits for the institution, it's designed to make profits for those whose money it is that's being loaned out, and that spread is designed to go straight back. So it creates economic value for those who actually own the money, not for the system. But for that to work, the system has to be inherently vastly distributed, and I'm going to be getting to that in these slides. Some of the foundation for what I'm talking about has actually existed previously in history. The best example that I can think of is in the United States, the small credit unions, which were essentially very, very small banks in factories. You know, it could be as few as 10, 20 people, maybe 100 or 1,000 people would take their paychecks, essentially keep them with one bookkeeper, you know, that was a fellow factory worker in this credit union, and that they would take that money, you know, essentially put it in a shoe can, and then as a factory worker wanted to go buy a house or wanted to go buy a car, they would loan that money. The bookkeeper would take a very small portion of that just as their fee for managing the entire plant's money. And savings. And when there was a pool of money left over, they would go to all of the people in the plant and say, hey, do we want to invest this in something? Do we want to buy stock in the company that we work for? You know, do we want to put it in another bank? Do we want to buy a CD with it? Do we want to buy war bonds or savings bonds? And these small credit unions were precedents for what became very, very large credit unions. That whereas, say, a teacher's union in a local area might own a credit union, and you had to be a member of that union to join the credit union. You know, today a lot of the deregulation has made it so that credit unions can consolidate and essentially act as larger banks that lose a lot of that active democratic initiative that was inherent in the smaller, more factory-oriented banks. That today they operate essentially the same as, you know, large corporate banks that have a board of directors that's really detached from the people who actually own and have vested stakes in the company. Another sort of parallel example for this is what happens in rural areas, in India and Africa, that the actual cash money that's generated in a lot of these poorer rural areas and even poorer urban areas is so little that as individuals hold it, it can't do much. You know, a person can't buy a piece of farm equipment with $5, but if you have a village of 100 or 200 people that are all pooling together the $5 they have so that one person can buy a piece of equipment to help the rest of the village out with, is, I think, a strong precedent for the model that I'm trying to introduce with cloud banking. It's something that's actually happening. It's something that relief workers are encouraging. Of course, this leads directly into the Kiva model, which I'm sure a lot of you have heard of, kiva.org, where you can go see a bunch of different projects for economic development that are people who are working with non-governmental organizations that are crafting together very small ideas. You know, just somebody who wants to buy maybe $100 or $200 worth of inventory to start a shop selling a particular thing in the area that they live in. That if you go to kiva.org and see all of these different projects, they can't come up with enough of these to fund. And they have an incredibly high repayment rate. You know, always in, you know, always in the high nines, 97, 98, 99% repayment rate in places that in Western economic terms are the forsaken ends of the earth. But the fact is that when you extend microcredit to smaller entities in these villages, that it becomes something that's a point of honor to repay. That the ideas that are thought out, working with NGOs and working with other people in villages, are very well put together, very well thought out, and that the market needs have been assessed, and that the odds for success are very, very good. And we can duplicate a lot of this information gathering and a lot of this success through the kinds of social networking technologies that we see today, and through implementing technology in a much more distributed, democratic fashion, instead of having to rely on banks to make these decisions with faulty information or loan money out to people, you know, who by second and third extensions are making not inherently great decisions and sometimes absolutely horrible decisions with large pools of money. Another example, one that I worked with when I was working at the Department of Treasury in the United States, were these entities called CDFIs, which were certified, had to go through a very rigorous application process with the Treasury Department, with the CDFI fund. That were specifically designed to help a lot of these smaller organizations, you know, either Native American tribes in the United States or groups that were working with urban entrepreneurs or people that essentially didn't have access to standard commercial credit to be able to have access to the capital loans and different things like that to be able to develop their ideas. CDFI is a program of the Department of Treasury to enhance and empower these organizations that can help local groups get access, and that what the idea is that if they can, these local organizations can find funding from local banks and local charities, that the Treasury Department would match that, allowing these larger pools, which they would then apply straight back into the community, and then undergo enhanced auditing to maintain their status as a CDFI and maintain access to future funding to help these organizations start out with. I think that a lot of that bureaucracy that I worked with, you know, is something that can be very easily replaced with the social networking technologies that we see today in the model that I like to call cloud banking. Other examples of these, third world micropayment services, people putting money essentially on their mobile phones as credit and then using them to buy things like sodas, buy things like clothing, and essentially engage in microbanking through the use of technology is a strong precedent for the kinds of things that I'm talking about. And as people lose access, you know, especially when the credit markets froze, people who were starting businesses essentially had to go to their neighbors and friends through blogs, through Facebook. Two examples that I can think of, there's a community store, there's a bookstore in Brooklyn that's opening up that has a blog and that wants to start and that essentially asked through their friends and neighbors for people to basically give them a loan. You know, they could choose their repayment methods, they could choose how much they wanted to borrow, and depending on what their interest rate and how much they were willing to loan the small bookstore was, they got things like discounts, access to special author events when the store opened up, and they were able to raise the capital of themselves directly from their friends and family, completely bypassing banks and other institutions, and able to open up their shop. Another example I heard of this was in my hometown in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a bar, which is actually very popular right now, essentially gave these little membership cards saying that if you loan us $50 to get started up for the next 3 years, you'll be able to get 20% off any drink that you buy here. You know, in profit terms, it's a great interest rate for the bank and it's a great deal for the customer. And that a lot of these things that people are starting to do in and of themselves, when we put in a more theoretical, more organized model, giving them access to the same kinds of technology and gateway services that banks enjoy can happen much more efficiently and much more rapidly, both for the benefit of those who have money in the system and those who are trying to borrow money from the system. You know, I've gone over a lot of this before, but the sort of identity trust networks that have been developed over the past 10, 20 years create a good precedent. Things like OpenID are something that can be easily used and implemented in this. Like I've said time and time again, social networking. Facebook was my prime example. You know, whether I'm not saying that Facebook is the specific technology, but the fact that it's out there and is in active use does, I think, create a good strong precedent for people to be able to code their own software to make this happen, or piggyback through APIs on existing social networks. Electronic voting. You know, the idea of making sure that a person's intent for engaging in a particular activity or voting for a certain person or voting for a certain idea is accurately reflected throughout what is a much larger system. The kinds of technical standards that are being developed in electronic voting, I think, will make a strong component to make cloud banking work. And then a lot of the deregulation in terms of how money is transferred between banks and financial entities leaves a lot of room and has opened up a lot of opportunity for people to be able to start their own small banks that are really nothing more than a server sitting in a rack somewhere that are able to process incoming wires and incoming transactions. And things like Check 21 have enabled people, at least in the United States, to scan their own checks. That you write a check somewhere, you put it in a computer, scan it in, or put it on a flatbed scanner, and are able to deposit it without ever having to set foot in a bank branch.
That
Check 21 was a redesign of the check system. In the United States, when you have to pay for your rent or you have to pay for large things and send money, not in the form of cash, but in some paper form to somebody else. And I know it works slightly differently in Germany. In Germany, you give people your bank account numbers, and then they deposit the money in your bank account, and the transaction is verified that way. In the US, it's the process is reversed through the form of a check, where you write the check to the person takes it to their bank, and the bank in turn goes and talks to your bank. The client's bank talks to your bank, pulls the money out that way. Check 21 was a system of standards that was implemented by the Federal Reserve in the United States that allows banks to, instead of actually sending the physical check to verify and reconcile the transaction, allowed them to send a scan of the check from the client bank to the recipient bank to be able to proof out the transaction, so that in the event of a discrepancy, instead of actually handling the physical paper object, you're just handling an image of it. And that in turn has allowed corporations and other entities to, instead of actually making a physical paper object, a virtual paper object, something that never existed in the form of paper but is a scan and is valid for transactions between banks in the Federal Reserve System in the United States. Automated clearinghouse is a part of Check 21 in the US. And the SWIFT network, just wire transfers between people, which is more standard in Europe, it's not so standard in the United States under that system, is another example of the kind of technology that helps enable financial transactions between entities. And these systems don't care how big you are. You know, whether if you're a bank of two people or a bank of 2 million people, you know, you still qualify for a routing number and account numbers and can still facilitate transactions that way. Large corporations will occasionally have their own smaller holding entities that exist in and of themselves with their own IBAN and BICs. Things that really need to be developed are furthering upon a lot of the things that I was just talking about. Better APIs for interfacing, you know, between banks. Better business plan financial modeling software. Right now, how to write a business plan is something that's not so much an ANSI standard as it could be. There are accounting standards out there. Right now, those accounting standards are in flux. There's a big rift between the Eurozone and the United States that they want us to abandon our generally accepted accounting procedures and adopt a more global set of accounting procedures. And all of these things are just basically ways for accountants to take information of how things work out there and present it in a format that's standardized, that allows people who aren't intimately familiar with how corporations run, just a general overview of what the books look like. Something that so that you can compare things like apples and oranges and determine financial worth. I think we need better systems to make things like that easier for people who aren't accountants or who aren't finance people to understand what the risks are and to understand what the costs are and to understand the opportunities for profit and loss. On top of all of that, in addition to developing these systems, just better instant auditing systems. The fact that most service corporations take, you know, 3 or 4 days to close their books on a monthly basis, or a week or 2 weeks to close their book on a yearly basis, when everything exists in the computer and when the status of all of these transactions is actually extant in databases. The fact that we can't close books almost instantly or have ongoing auditing processes that will let us know what the problems are ahead of time you know, before the closing date of our accounting records, I think is ludicrous. We have the technology and we're able to do it, but the fact is people just aren't willing to either develop the standard so that it satisfies the clients, satisfies the audit boards, it satisfies the accounting regulatory bodies, or satisfies the auditor, and that the auditors, because there's no money in helping corporations achieve a faster close date, just aren't encouraging or pushing their companies to do it. That auditing firms get more money from fees and doing things like that, and prolonging a longer close and prolonging a longer audit process that doesn't enhance quality, but enhance these sort of that rent-seeking gatekeeping property. And as an accountant, I take responsibility for, you know, earning a living off of some of that rent-keeping. The other thing that we need, I think, to focus on is enhanced banking kiosk networks. As we know, actually paying people to be somewhere and paying rent for a building that actually exists somewhere costs a lot of money. Just like we've seen, you know, travel agents sort of disappear, except in very special circumstances, and we've seen, you know, other sorts of businesses cease to exist. You know, record stores aren't around anymore. That same kind of deprecation, I think, can happen with banks. That when we actually have bankers who are working in certain physical locations, that they should be very highly specialized, highly trained people that can't, that do things that computers can't do. And that all of the other things that an ATM can handle, all the other automated transactions, I think we should start to see out there. And as we see ATMs owned by perhaps, you know, an entity that's not a bank, that we should see full service machines that are out there that can handle a lot of these transactions on behalf of many other banks. And that this precedent actually exists in the United States in what's called the co-op network among a bunch of different credit unions there. First of all, before I actually get into sort of a theoretical building of the network, are there any questions so far? Yeah, down here. Yeah.
I think that all of the bottom four points in this slide require the cooperation of the actual banks that exist right now. Is that correct?
No.
I mean better interbank APIs and better kiosk networks and audit systems doesn't require them to cooperate?
It requires people with knowledge of how those things work. It requires people who have worked in banks or worked on banking software. It requires accountants and economists and people with that kind of knowledge, but it doesn't require the actual cooperation of those physical entities.
Banking, but you do have to duplicate their competencies then. You do have to design those enhanced banking kiosks.
I don't think you have to duplicate the competencies of the organization so much as duplicate, and not even duplicate, but take advantage of the skill sets that people bring to banks, that they're actual skill sets that people have. The parallel is, of course, the open source software model, that you're not, open source software projects are not duplicating the core capabilities of software companies. But what they're doing is taking the capabilities of individual programmers, bringing them together, and working on projects collaboratively. The same sort of collaboration from an intellectual standpoint is very possible in banking, and that involves lawyers, accountants, and not necessarily the banks themselves to cooperate to bring these things together. I mean, banks don't like the fact that every corner shop has their own ATM that doesn't belong to a bank that charges, you know, maybe a euro to facilitate a transaction. They don't like that. But that collaboration that led to that and the systems that enable that ATM, that's a non-bank ATM and allows a non-bank entity to make money off of the financial system, is an example of the kind of collaboration that I think we can bring to cloud banking. And I'm running a little bit out of time, so I think we're going to go back there and then to George real quickly. Unless, was there a question on this side of the room? Okay, we'll get to you next real quick.
My question is more about the inflation and banks being able to lend 9-to-1. So if a bank opens with $1,000, they can lend up to $10,000 with the Federal Reserve's backing. How does that affect this kind of thing?
In terms of leveraging, cloud bank or individual pools of money, you know, the pockets that form the cloud, can decide how leveraged they want to be. They can have a leverage of 100%, a relative leverage of 100%, which says that, you know, we're not going to loan money that we don't have. We're not going to engage in the process of creating money. or they can take advantage of 0% leverage, and they could say, well, we're going to leverage up to as much as, you know, we possibly can, given whatever the reserve requirements are at the time. And we need that sort of diversity in leverage-making decisions in the cloud. Some groups of people are going to be very risk-averse. Some people are going to be, you know, very risk-tolerant. And that we can't say, we can't just sort of arbitrarily set a floor of what that leverage is going to be, because depending on the decisions that each of these smaller cells across the cloud are going to make, the fact that there's still diversity inherent in the process is what leads to the resilience and the effectiveness and efficiency of the system overall. Okay, right there, and then I think we got one over there real quick.
Can cloud banking finance businesses that are more complicated than a local bookstore or agriculture operation? And if it is possible, how can you keep Bernie Madoff out?
Okay, how can you, the last part of that question?
How can you keep Bernie Madoff out of Ponzi schemes?
You know, honestly, the Ponzi scheme will continue to exist. There's nothing that you're going to be able to do about that. That people, anytime you find somebody who's providing that consistent a return, human greed is always going to gravitate to those people. That's inevitable. But the first part of your question, I think cloud banking can fund any entity. They can fund and buy stock in incredibly large entities. If a bunch of people want to have a bunch of savings that's left over that can't be directly applied into their network, and they want to achieve a return off of it, they can, as a group, decide to loan that into some kind of high-risk portfolio. Or they can, say, divide it up into different things, into different mutual funds, and do what they want to with that spare pool of cash. But the idea is that once more opportunities for lending within the network become available, that that money gets pulled back out, and that the decision ultimately rests with those whose savings it is. That the idea is to introduce that sort of decision-making back to the people whose money it is, as opposed to relying on banks to make those decisions for us and profit off of the decisions they make and get rewarded for the mistakes that they make by virtue of the fact that those savings are insured by governments. One question over here, and then I'm going to jump right back into my slides.
Yes, I have a more general question, Nick. I wonder whether this system is somehow related with the idea of cooperative banks. You know, in Europe at least, there are banks like Raiffeisen Bank, which are owned basically by the people. They're not-for-profit institutions, and the Volksbank, is that?
Yeah, that's the equivalent. The problem that I'm seeing with those institutions is that you're still ceding sovereignty over your money to a smaller subset of people within that organization. And in cooperative banking, and you know, before we had the ability and access to the technology that I'm describing, that was necessary. That it was impractical to, you know, gather all 1,000 people in the bank and then have a meeting every Tuesday to decide, you know, where is this money going to go. That was incredibly inefficient. But I think that we have systems today that will allow people who want to be more actively involved in how their money is spent, making and micromanaging those decisions. And people who just say, look, you know, I trust that the people who are actually making these decisions are doing the right thing. I'm getting a good return on my money. I'm not going to participate. But they have the option to participate in that decision-making process, whereas before, in the cooperative banking model, you didn't. From a regulatory standpoint, the ability to do this exists in the laws that enable cooperative banking, that enable Volksbanks, that enable credit unions. But instead of creating boards and things like that actually make the decisions, it's only a short matter of administrative law and agreement to say, as a board, we're going to empower all of our members to make these decisions, except in very special circumstances. And just because I'm running a little bit out of time, building a network like this, you know, is very simple. A bank can be a computer lying in a rack somewhere. That with that, you can offer basic banking services, Eurocard, debit card, checking in the United States. And then as a small group of people, you know, just 10 people are saying putting half of their paycheck in the bank and leaving half of their paycheck in the traditional banking structure that they're in, can start working on an as-needed basis to provide lending services that are generating interest and generating revenue to help pay the costs of that bank on an as-needed basis. And then as more of these loans are made, loans are repaid, data is collected, that you get a better sense of who's within this, you know, within your immediate structure, you can start working with other people who have done the same sorts of things and creating networks of these independent unions. all the while retaining control over where exactly the money in your particular pool is going. For example, funding small businesses, like I said, through a social network linking up with all these other independent smaller entities, you can send out an invite, you know, join my small business, here's my business plan. And as a part of that, you know, through the same sorts of messaging features, just like by saying, you know, I'm sorry I can't make it to your birthday party, I'm going to be in Europe, you can say, well, you know, actually, I don't think that your estimates for the viability of the market in this particular sphere are correct. You know, you can flame somebody about their business plan and actually make them think about it and bring that bit of knowledge to everybody else who might want to invest in it. And that by taking advantage of the knowledge that exists in these pools, you can create a better assessment for the risk of particular institutions and help the person. You know, a person in one of these networks might actually have a pretty crappy idea. And he might be able to pitch this crappy idea just because he's a great guy and get a whole bunch of people to invest in it. And it might take that one person to say, hey, look, you know, this has been tried before, it's a crappy idea. And that one person in perhaps a sea of thousands, you know, could change and potentially save not only the person from making the bad idea, but save all of the people who might be investing in that idea and allow them to pull their money out before it's too late. And in addition, they can call upon on these networks for legal advice, for accounting advice, and not have to go pay for a lot of these professional services if they can leverage that knowledge that exists within their social networks as a whole. But more importantly, you know, the ability to create credit opportunities for people, for everybody, you know, for people who need to use credit cards to buy certain things, for people who buy houses, for people who buy, you know, boats and cars and various different things like that, ways that people use credit, people can not only use their savings to gain, you know, much more of that interest, you know, as an investment vehicle, but the people who are borrowing the money can pay much lower interest rates by virtue of the fact they're not paying the overhead that banks provide. And in addition, if a person, for whatever reason, is unable to make payments, that they can renegotiate the terms of their loan much more easily within these social networks than they would ever be able to do with banks. And so, you know, the last final core precept that I want to leave you with is that instead of dealing as individuals, you know, with large corporations, giving them our money and borrowing it back, you know, let's use a lot of these social networking technologies, our shared experiences, and the stuff that Web 2.0 is providing us, you know, to enhance our social life for something that's potentially useful. And that's pretty much all I have. Are there any final questions? I think I have time for one question, then I need to see the stage. Yeah, go. Good. My microphone's on its way, real quick. Oh, is the next speaker here so they can start setting up? Oh, okay.
Just one quick thing. I just want to point everybody who found this interesting. There's a video out there on the net. It's called Us Now, which actually. I'm not affiliated with it, but which talks about these points, about how processes which have been very monopolistic are going out to a crowd of people. And it's a 60-minute presentation, and it has exactly some of these themes in it. Just Google it. It's called Us Now, 60-minute video on Vimeo. Should be a nice watch for everybody.
Okay. Be sure to email that for me so I can put it on the website under the cloud banking heading. Great. Thank you so much again. See you guys tomorrow.